Hello, beautiful souls, and welcome to Roses and Rituals. This is the podcast where we explore the mystical, the magical, and the downright mysterious world of energy healing and spiritual practices. I am your host, Caitlin. I am a herbalist, a certified Reiki master, and a certified yoga instructor. And we are diving into the enchanting world of Reiki today. This is episode one, an introduction to Reiki and understanding the basics. And whether you're a seasoned healer or you're just starting on your journey and you're curious to know what it's like, what Reiki is, what healing is all about, well, I'm happy to report that you have come to the right place. So get comfy, grab a cup of tea, some coffee, and let's dive in. So what exactly is Reiki? I want you to imagine being able to tap into this universal life force energy, right? This cosmic energy that's all around us, and we are able to tap into it and channel it for healing. And I know that that sounds something like it's something out of a sci-fi movie. I get that for sure. But that's actually what Reiki is. The word Reiki is derived from two Japanese words, rei, meaning universal, and ki, which means life energy. So Reiki literally translates to universal life energy. What Reiki is that it's a Japanese healing technique that uses energy from the universe to help promote physical, emotional, and spiritual well-being. No one holds the rights to it. As far as I'm concerned, if someone out there knows differently, please let me know. But from what I've been told and what I've been taught, no one holds the rights to Reiki. Reiki is not trademarked. It is not patented. Reiki is not a religion. It is just a healing system. So the first order of business, the first thing that we're going to do in this intro to Reiki is talk about the history of Reiki. If you're sitting there, you're probably thinking that this is a pipe dream. Reiki isn't real. It's too good to be true. This is silly. I get that. But I want you to understand that Reiki has been around for hundreds and hundreds of years. And it was rediscovered by a Mikeo Use in the late 1800s. And at one point in his life, Mikeo Use became super ill. There was an epidemic that was happening in Tokyo, and he was struggling to stay alive, y'all. Like, he was near death, okay? And this experience led him to having a spiritual awakening. And that's common, right? A lot of people who have near-death experiences tend to have some type of spiritual awakening or like an epiphany. And that's where he was in his life. He had this awakening, and he became really interested in discovering what the purpose of life was. And he kind of made it his mission to find out what the purpose of life was. And in his search, he came across this description of a special state of consciousness that once you achieve it, not only were you able to understand what your life purpose was, you would also be guided to achieving your life purpose. And that special state, and I apologize if I butcher the pronunciation, the special state of consciousness is called Shinditsumai. And in this special state, this person is always at peace, regardless of what is taking place in the world around them. Like, you know, the world is really shitty right now. There's wars happening, famine happening, you know, child slavery happening. There is a lot of terrible shit happening in the world right now. But even with all of the terrible things happening in the world, this person who has this this special state of consciousness will be at peace in their soul. They would still have hope, you know, hope in humanity, hope in the world, hope that things will get better. Another special feature of this you know, special state of consciousness, this Shinditsu Mai, is that it maintains itself without any effort on the part of the individual. So the person who achieves this state doesn't have to put forth any effort in maintaining this special state of consciousness or keeping it, you know. It's once they require or once they achieve it, they always have it. It happens spontaneously. And it's sort of like a type of enlightenment. Like once you kind of achieve it, you know, it's there. You have that aha moment, and you always have that aha moment. You have that understanding. And so Makeo Use dedicated his life to achieving this state of peace. So once he heard about it, once he discovered or came across this state of consciousness, it led him to joining a monastery, and he studied there for 3 years. And after 3 years, he goes to his teacher and he's like, I'm not satisfied. I've been here for 3 years. I haven't achieved Shinditsu Mai. What the heck? And his teacher suggested something a little crazy. His teacher basically suggested that he would have to undergo a more severe practice. A practice where the student would be willing to die in order to achieve Shinditsu Mai, to achieve this state of consciousness, this state of peace. And so with that in mind, Makeo Use was like, all right, cool. And he prepared for death. And it's crazy to say. I know, it sounds crazy because it kind of is. He prepared for death. And in February of 1922, he took a trip up to this sacred mountain. It's called Mount Kurama. I hope I'm pronouncing that right. A lot of my pronunciations are probably going to be trash, and I apologize in advance. But Mount Kurama is a sacred mountain. It's a popular mountain. And what we know about this mountain is that there's a small waterfall there. And even to this day, people go to this waterfall to meditate. And this meditation involves you standing underneath the waterfall and allowing the water to just flow from over the top of your head. And this practice is said to activate the crown chakra. And Japanese Reiki masters think that that's what Makeo Use did when he went up the mountain, that he used this meditation as a part of his practice. It's important to note that while he is on this mountain, he is fasting. All he is doing is fasting and meditating. And we're going to fast forward a couple of weeks. Now it's March. Remember, he started this journey. He went up this mountain in February, and it's now March, and it's the 21st day. So he's been on this mountain meditating and fasting for 21 days. And on the 21st day of his fast, according to him, in his records, he says that a powerful light suddenly entered into his mind through his crown chakra. Remember, he was probably sitting underneath this waterfall that was activating the hell out of his crown chakra. So it was probably super activated. So this powerful light is entering his mind through the top of his head, and he felt as if he had gotten struck by lightning. And then he passes out. He falls unconscious. And he wakes up the next day, and he has this realization. He's like, yo, before I passed out, I was mad weak. Like, I was near death, essentially. I had been fasting for 21 days. I was meditating, sitting under this waterfall. It was almost my time. And now I'm filled with this vitality, this energy that I can't describe, that I've never experienced before. He acquired this spiritual energy that replaced his normal consciousness, and it was replaced with this, you know, amazing new level of awareness. So he gets super excited, and he's like, hey, I need to talk to my teacher about this. I need to go back to the monastery and have a conversation with my teacher. So he starts down the mountain. He's running down the mountain. And as anyone would probably do, he stubs his toe. And so now he's like, God damn, my toe is killing me. He's grabbing onto his toe. You know, every time you stub your toe on, you know, the coffee table or on your, you know, your bed frame, like the first thing you do is grab it because it feels right to grab wherever you hit and kind of wait for the pain to subside. But what he's realizing is that there's this energy flowing from his hands all by itself. He's not doing anything different or special. He's just feeling this energy flowing through his hands into his toe where the pain is, and eventually the pain subsides. And he's amazed by this. And he's realizing that in addition to achieving his new state of consciousness, he's received this gift. He's received a gift of healing. And it dawns on him that he's received his purpose. Now, remember when we talked about Shinditsumai, that once you achieve this state, and maybe I didn't mention this, but when you achieve this state, it's going to help you understand what your life purpose is. I think I might have mentioned that. Yes. So you're going to understand what your life purpose is. And so this is where he comes to understand what he's going to do with the rest of his life. He's going to become a healer. He's going to teach others how to heal, and he's going to help heal his community. And so now it's April in 1922. He has achieved what he has set out to achieve. He acquired this special state of consciousness. And he's out. He's out of the monastery. He said, I got what I needed, and it's time for me to move forward and do some other things. So he moves to Tokyo, and he starts this healing society that he names the Usei Reiki Healing Method Society. And he also opens up a Reiki clinic in Harajuku, Tokyo. And this is where he starts teaching classes. This is where he's training people how to administer Reiki, and he's also giving treatment. So he's getting clients. People are coming to this clinic to receive Reiki. And eventually the demand for Reiki becomes so great that he outgrows this clinic. And in 1925, he decides to build a bigger one in Tokyo. And because of this, his reputation as a healer starts to spread all over Japan, and he begins to travel so that he can teach more people and he can treat more people. And during his travels across Japan, he directly teaches more than 2,000 students. And he also initiates 20 Shihan. And my understanding of Shihan is they're like a master martial artist, right? It's like the highest level. It's an honorable title to get if you're a master martial artist. And he initiates 20 of them. Japanese government also gives him an award. He wins the Kun Santo Award for doing honorable work with helping others and healing others. And so he does this for many years. And unfortunately, in March 9th, 1926 to be exact, while traveling to teach Reiki to train other students, he ends up suffering a stroke and he passes away. So that's a very brief history of Mikeo Usei, who rediscovered Reiki and started teaching it all over Japan and training and healing others. But it's important to give some honorable mentions to two of his students, one being Hayashi and the second being Takada. And so Usei is training people. He has a bunch of students, and one of his students is Hayashi. And he asks, meaning Mikeo Usei asks Hayashi to open his own Reiki clinic because Hayashi has a lot of medical experience. And Mikeo Usei really likes that. And so Hayashi heeds his words, his advice, and he opens up his own Reiki clinic. And this is where a lot of his contributions to Reiki come into play. The first contribution is that Hayashi starts to record which hand positions are best for certain illnesses and conditions. And he creates a guideline. He creates guidelines for Reiki healing. He's also the reason why we lay down now when we're undergoing a Reiki treatment. Originally, Mikeo Usei would have a client sit in a chair, and that's how he would administer Reiki to his clients. But Hayashi changed that up and had them laying down on a table to administer the Reiki. And that is the method that we most people use to this day. You could still do Reiki with a chair, but I know when I do in-person sessions as well as, you know, virtual sessions, I have my clients lay down. He is also the reason why a lot of masters, Reiki masters, teach Reiki level 1 and level 2 together. So he made a lot of contributions to the Reiki community, and that's important to mention. He took a trip to Hawaii, and this is prior to the attack on Pearl Harbor, and I know that sounds weird, but it's important to mention. He takes a trip to Hawaii, and because of his trip, the Japanese military ask him for information. They want the deets. They want details. They want him to be undercover, like, tell us what you know. Right? They ask him for information. They ask him for info on warehouses and military targets. And Hayashi refuses. And they declare him a traitor. And they say, your family is going to be disgraced. And you all are going to be ostracized from society. And he doesn't want that to happen. So instead of having his whole family be disgraced and ostracized, he unfortunately carries out ritualistic suicide, and he dies honorably on May 11th, 1940. And now let's talk about Takata. Takata was born and raised in Hawaii to Japanese immigrant parents, and her father worked in the sugar fields, and she married a bookkeeper on a plantation where she worked. And when her husband died in 1930, she became the sole provider to her family. And she basically worked herself to the bone. She worked herself into illness. And after 5 years of nonstop work, little sleep, you know, she fell ill, as honestly anybody would if they were working themselves to death, essentially. She became ill and had severe abdominal pain. And she also claims that she had a lung condition. And she also ended up suffering a nervous breakdown. And to add more to it, you know, when it rains, it pours. On top of all of the illnesses that she acquired, on top of having a nervous breakdown, her sister passes away. And now it is up to her. It's her responsibility to travel to Japan, where her parents have settled, to deliver this news. So she's there. She's delivered the news to her parents, and they start planning the funeral for her sister. And once the funeral is over, she enters herself into a hospital. She says, okay, I need to take some time. I need to figure out what's wrong with me. I need to heal. I need to work on me, or else I can't do anything for any of you. Right? Makes sense. So she goes into the hospital, and she is diagnosed with a tumor. She's diagnosed with gallstones. She's diagnosed with appendicitis and asthma. And she is told that she needs to prepare for surgery. But instead of doing surgery, she says, you know what? I want to look into my options. And she does her research. And instead of doing surgery, she opts into going to Hayashi's clinic instead. So now she is at Hayashi's clinic. And she has two practitioners working with her daily for hours on end, administering Reiki to her. And after about 4 months of being there, she is completely healed. And so naturally, if this were the case for anyone and, you know, they had all these illnesses and they spend hours on end for 4 months with two practitioners and eventually they become healed, naturally, you're going to want to learn this method. And so she wanted to learn Reiki herself. And so she worked with Dr. Hayashi to receive her level 1 degree in Reiki in 1936, and then worked with him for a year, and then after that received her level 2 degree in Reiki, and then made her grand return to Hawaii in 1937. And Hayashi actually followed her to Hawaii. Now you see where the stories are connecting, right? He goes to Hawaii, and they work together to establish Reiki there. And it's when they're in Hawaii that Hayashi actually initiates Takata as a Reiki master. And so it's important to mention that if it weren't for Takata, Reiki probably would not be practiced by people around the world, even today. She taught Reiki all over Hawaii, and she also traveled throughout the states teaching, training, and initiating folks to becoming Reiki masters. And before her passing, it is said that she taught around 22 Reiki masters who then went on to carry the tradition. I know that was a lot. That was a lot, but yet it was still a super brief overview of the history of, you know, Reiki and Mikayo Use and how it was rediscovered. But if you made it this far, you're a real one, and I super appreciate you. And I hope that you stick with me just for a little bit longer, because it's only going to get juicier. But before we get into how the body uses Reiki and how it works and all of that good stuff, we're going to take a little break. So I will see you back here in just a little bit. Okay, so now we're gonna get into how the body uses Reiki and how it actually works. So one of the things I love about Reiki is its simplicity. There are no complex rituals, no rules. Well, there are rules, but it's not that elaborate. There are no elaborate rules or elaborate setups to it. All you need is your intention and your hands. Practitioners use their hands to channel energy into their client, into the recipient, whether it's themselves giving yourself Reiki or whether you're working with someone else, right? The energy goes where it's needed the most. It's like your soul has this GPS for all of its healing needs. We do not dictate where the energy goes. The body does. Whether it's your own body, whether it's your client, the body will know what it needs, and we are just the facilitators. We are just the conduit to help that energy get to where it needs to go. So let's dive deeper into this energy, right? We understand that every particle vibrates at a specific frequency. In more woo-woo terms, that frequency is called consciousness. And it's this consciousness that is activating things within us. It's this consciousness that's helping our hearts to beat. It's, you know, making our eyelids blink involuntarily. This consciousness, it's also in everything. It is, it's in you, it's in me, it's in your pets, it's in the plants, it's in the trees. Any living thing that you can think of has this consciousness, has this energy, right? It basically synchronizes all of the events that's going on within our bodies, the things that we cannot control. And each day, our bodies are working to maintain balance. Our bodies are in a constant state of maintaining balance, whether you're healthy or especially when you're sick. You know, think back to when you had your last fever. A fever is essentially your brain saying, hey, a pathogen has entered, a foreign pathogen body has entered in to this human being, and it's not supposed to be here. I'm turning up the heat, I'm cranking it up in this body, and hopefully that will help kill this pathogen so that we can go back to being in balance. That's essentially what a fever is. So no matter what's going on in your body, it is constantly trying to maintain that balance, that homeostasis, if you will. And understand that trauma is also energy. So when we go through trauma of any kind, we end up storing that energy. We store that trauma typically in our bodies. If you do not deal with your trauma, if you don't deal with the emotions that come with that trauma, it gets stored as energy in your body. We store them in the form of memories or beliefs, and as they accumulate around the same theme, parts of us become out of sync. Let me see if I can put that in simpler terms. When we hold on to trauma or traumatic memories, the feelings and the emotions from that trauma, when we hold on to that and we don't deal with it, eventually physical manifestations of that trauma start to form. So you see this a lot in women, and I can attest to this, unfortunately. Lots of women go through physical, emotional, and sexual trauma at some point in time in their life. And women also have the most perfect place to store a lot of their trauma, a lot of their emotions they don't deal with. We have this empty, dark cave sitting directly at our sacral chakra, and I am talking about our womb space. Now, I looked into some numbers, right, of different reproductive issues. And all the women that I know, the majority of women that I know, have some type of reproductive issue. And they have also gone through some type of serious trauma, be it physical, emotional, or sexual. Now, here are the numbers. 11% of women in America alone suffer from endometriosis. 60% of African American women will have fibroids by the time they are 35. I am one of those women. And that goes up to 80% by the time they reach 50. White women, 40% by the time they're 35, and that goes up to 70% by the time they're 50. And around 13% of women suffer from PCOS. A lot of women go through trauma in their lifetime. Unfortunately, it's sad, but true. And as you can see, a lot of that emotional trauma tends to not get dealt with, and it ends up becoming physical manifestations of that trauma. And because a lot of women go through things like sexual trauma, that is going to impact your sacral chakra, which in turn is connected to your reproductive system. So it's no wonder why so many women have such a breadth of reproductive issues. Me, for instance, I have had fibroids. I've recently had them removed, and I had over 40 of them, 40 fibroids removed from my uterus. I also have endometriosis, and I am someone who has gone through sexual and emotional trauma in my life multiple times, unfortunately. So that is just a little correlation, a little connection to help you guys understand that if when you don't deal with your emotions, they do become physical. Like, think of a broken heart. Have you ever heard of old married couples that have been together their entire lives, and when one of them passes on, the other one will die from a broken heart? The pain of losing your loved one, that emotional pain becomes a physical manifestation. And typically it's like a heartache, or not a heartache. It is heartache, but I mean a heart attack, or maybe even like a stroke. You know, people die of broken hearts all the time. So I honestly can make this be a whole episode in and of itself, but I digress. So let's move on. All this to say is that taking care of your emotional state is so flippin' important. It is so important to the overall health of your body. And we know this as practitioners. If you are a practitioner, you know that there are lots of people out there who are not dealing with their emotional state. And therefore, they come to you saying, this hurts, that hurts. You know, my shoulders are killing me all the time. My lower back is hurting all the time. And so when I get those clients in and they tell me there are certain parts of their body that are always constantly, consistently hurting, it helps me to pinpoint maybe what chakra is really going to be utilizing the majority of this energy. And again, I'm not telling the energy where to go. The body is going to do that, but it helps me as a healer to work with that person to help them start to unpack some of their emotional stuff. And it's not just, you know, getting that healing in terms of Reiki, but also doing the work. There's a lot of work that needs to be done when you're undergoing a spiritual transformation or any type of spiritual shift, right? It's not always sunshine and rainbows. It can get very dark. And as a healer and as a practitioner, I'm there to help my clients through that time. And so just knowing what those physical manifestations are and starting to unpack the emotional trauma behind it really kind of helps set the client in motion to serious, what's the word I'm looking for? To serious overall well-being, not just physical, but also emotional and also spiritual. It's a well-rounded therapy, so to speak. So like I said, we don't decide where the energy goes. The client's own body and energy is going to make that decision, and we're just going to be the facilitators. We are just the conduit. We hold the space for that client's body and the client's mind to see all of the possibilities that it has in regards to healing itself. And once the body decides which route it wants to go, it takes that Reiki energy that we're facilitating to the body and it begins to restore itself and brings itself back to a state of balance, back to a state of homeostasis. Now, I know some of you might be wondering, okay, thanks for that, but how does this all actually work? And that is a great question. And I want you to think of Reiki or receiving Reiki as a cosmic tune-up. And during your session, the practitioner is going to place their hands lightly on you or just above your body. Some people don't like being touched, and that is totally fine. If you have a good practitioner, they will make sure to know whether or not they can place their hands on you or not. And if not, they'll place them just above. But this allows for the Reiki energy to flow through them, to come through their hands and into the recipient. It's non-invasive and it's a very gentle process that brings, hopefully, the recipient deep relaxation, pain relief, and emotional healing. I know for me, a lot of times when I do Reiki sessions, my clients will end up falling asleep. I have had some people snore before, and when they finally come back or when they wake up when I'm finished with the session, they're like, oh my God, that was so relaxing. That was just exactly what I needed. I feel so refreshed. And I can attest to that. When I had my very first Reiki session, it was absolutely amazing. I genuinely felt like I was walking on clouds. I kid you not. I swear. I felt like I was floating when I finished my first Reiki session. I was sold. On top of the fact that I actually had, I had a physical experience as well, where while I was undergoing my Reiki, I could feel balls of energy shifting inside of me. So I remember starting to feel this ball of energy build up in my heart chakra. And I remember it floating up into my throat chakra. And then I had to like open my mouth and yawn, or I had to like expel that energy. And I just remember being so amazed. Like, that was the first time that I had ever actually felt the energy in my body moving and shifting. And I was sold after that. And that's when I was like, hey, where did you learn this? Who did you learn from? Send me the info. I need to be able to do this because this is just freaking amazing. And folks who have a Reiki 1 attunement are able to perform Reiki on themselves. So once I learned how to do Reiki, I was able to do that for myself. I didn't necessarily have to go to another person, another practitioner, to achieve that walking on clouds state. Self-Reiki is an amazing way to start on your healing journey. All you have to do is spend a few minutes every day placing your hands on different parts of your body. And when you go through the training, you will learn those different hand positions, right? So you'll do those hand positions on different parts of your body, focusing on different areas, different chakras. And we'll get into chakras in a different episode. But you'll also set intentions to heal yourself, to send energy healing to yourself, and to kind of utilize that healing energy throughout the rest of your day. It's kind of like giving yourself a daily dose of love and light, quote unquote. You can do this in the morning while you're brushing your teeth or setting your intentions for the day, or maybe before you even get out of bed, your alarm goes off, and before you get up, you give yourself some Reiki for like 3 to 5 minutes. Or you could do it like me, where I like to do it in bed at night before I go to sleep, and I kind of reflect on the day. I give myself some Reiki, and it really helps put me into a restful state of mind where I can sleep a little bit better. Either way is fine, but self-Reiki is just so instrumental to your Reiki journey and to your healing journey. So 10 out of 10 recommend at least getting your Reiki one attunement if you're thinking about it. Reiki is also super versatile. It's used for everything. It's used for everything from reducing your stress and anxiety to managing your pain and your chronic conditions. It's great for pets and plants. Yes, you heard that right. You can give Reiki to your pets. You can give Reiki to your plants. You can use Reiki to help heal your furry little friends, your fur babies, and help boost the health of your Monstera. You can. If you have a Reiki 2 attunement, you can do distance Reiki. You could send Reiki into the future. You can send Reiki to friends who are living across the country. That's how I and other practitioners, all other practitioners, are able to do virtual sessions. It's because we have our Reiki 2 attunement. And the next episode will be all on, I believe, either episode 2 or episode 3 will be on the attunement process. So stay tuned for that. But once you do get your Reiki 2 attunement, you can do distance Reiki, virtual Reiki with family, friends, clients. And like I just said, you can send Reiki into the future. Like, let's say you're pregnant or you have a client that's pregnant and they just hit, or you just hit 40 weeks. You are getting ready. It's go time. Your bags are packed. The car seat's already in there in the car. You're just waiting. You're just waiting for that moment. You can take a second to send future you, the you that will be, or the client who will be in labor at the hospital or at home or wherever, and is, you know, contemplating their life choices at that very moment. You can send that person, that version of you, Reiki beforehand. Because I'm sure when you are in the midst of it and you are in labor, the last thing you're going to be thinking about is Reiki and meditating and sending yourself love and light. You're not going to probably want to do that. But if you have your Reiki 2 attunement, you can do it beforehand. How amazing is that? Or maybe you're a student and you have a test or a final, you know, or maybe you just entered corporate America and you have this crazy presentation that you have to give to your boss coming up and you're super nervous about it. You can send future you Reiki so that you can be more relaxed and ace that test, or, you know, kill it on your presentation. Like, you can do that for yourself. I give Reiki to my food all the time. I send Reiki to my water all the time before I drink it, my coffee, my tea. Like, the options in terms of using Reiki are fucking endless. Excuse my language. If you didn't know by now, I like to cuss. I am a sailor, so I hope that does not offend you. But yeah, the options are endless. Reiki is ridiculously versatile. And we will be diving into all the ways that this is possible in future episodes to come. And there you have it, folks. that is a very brief introduction into the world of Reiki. I hope that you're as excited as I am to embark on this podcast journey together. And our next episode, episode 2, we are going to dive a little bit deeper into the 5 principles of Reiki. And then episode 3 will be all about the attunement process. So I hope that you will come and join me in our episodes to come. And before we wrap up, I just want to say I would love to hear from you. If you have questions about Reiki, if you have questions about energy healing or anything that we've discussed or will discuss in the future, maybe you have a personal experience or a story that you want to share. Whatever it is, I'm here for it and I want to hear from you. So send your questions, send your thoughts and your stories to info@roseritual.com. I'll be picking a few to feature and answer in future episodes, so don't be shy. Your question might just help someone else on their journey too. And if you choose to be anonymous, just make mention of that in your email and I will be sure to not state your name. Thank you so much for tuning in to Roses and Rituals. Follow me on social at Rose Ritual Apothecary for updates and for more content. If you enjoyed today's episode, please subscribe, rate, and review the podcast. I would really appreciate it and love it if you did. There will be references in the show notes for all of the information that I gave you today, just in case you're interested in doing some of your own research. And feel free to reach out to me. Hit me up on social or send me your questions at info@roseritual.com. If you have any type of questions or need any more explanations from what we discussed today, I'm here for it. I'm here for you. All right. In good faith and healing, I want you to take care of yourselves and each other. And until next time, bye.